Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I welcome you to the show. This is Donna Sebo. Welcome to an hour of mind power. Have you ever desired to be a writer? Have you thought maybe that you would write your life story, maybe the story of someone else? Do you think as a writer that you could only do nonfiction or fiction? Whatever your belief system might be, as far as becoming a writer, the gentleman we are going to be talking with today, Mr. Von Sherman, is a man that has gone into both aspects, both in the nonfiction area as well as fiction. We're going to be talking about both of his books. The first one is titled Sea Travels, and it's the memoirs of a 20th century master mariner that I just think it's absolutely fascinating. And then we'll be also talking about his novel, Sasha Plotkin's Deceit. And it is superbly written. Von Sherman, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Donna.
You don't mind if I call you Von, do you?
No, I just called you Donna. So.
All right. I always like to make sure people are comfortable. Von, you're a very interesting man. You are a Northwesterner, born and raised in Seattle, but you have done so many different types of work, everything from working as a biologist in fisheries in Alaska and Washington State. You also have worked for the CIA. You were involved with the CIA for more than 20 years. And then you've gotten involved with nonprofit agencies, community colleges. You're a man that has had a very eclectic background. I think it's really an inspiration showing how an individual can cross territories, if you will, into different venues. Why did you decide to take on Sea Travels, the story of J. Holger Christensen, and how did you meet this man? How did your paths cross?
I knew Holger Christensen through my life because he was my uncle.
Ah,
my uncle,
okay.
By marriage. And one of my first memories, very, very young, probably 5 years old, I traveled on a boat with him across the Sound. And I still remember that trip very fondly, and I was very fond of him, and we had a wonderful relationship through my life and through his. He's gone now.
Now, with him, with your uncle, you often probably heard his various stories. What made him decide to sit down with you so you could write his story? Because at the time that he was involved in being with the ships traveling to different ports around the world, it was an amazing time. His father was an incredible man. What made him decide to sit down and talk with you?
It goes back to a trip that my late wife and I took to Europe. And Holger was a second-generation Dane and had never been to Denmark. And we went back to Scandinavia because we'd lived there almost 10 years. We went back every 2 or 3 years. And on one of those trips, we invited Holger to come with us so he could see Denmark. And for those 3 weeks, he told us sea tales. And by the end of the trip, I told him that this is something that we can't lose. It's you live mm-hmm. through a historic time, and why don't you tell me your story, and we'll put it together as a memoir. And we had a wonderful year following that. He would come over from Bainbridge Island every Wednesday morning, and he would bring a tape that he had recorded during the week. and we would listen to that tape, and then I would give him a new set of questions to record the next week, and then we would go out and have some lunch. And we both just enjoyed that year tremendously. That's the way that worked out.
It fascinated me because it represents a cross-section of history and time that really wasn't that long ago. And the fact that his father had, you know, gone through so much and just had, you know, he was one of six kids, and the family was of a very self-sufficient demeanor. That it was very much, I think, typical of that period of time. And there was no social security, there was no welfare, and there was just a strong sense of integrity. That's the one thing that was a thread throughout his entire story. And I think that it represents something of a cultural background, but also almost a code with people at that time. Not that there weren't the crooks and the thieves, they're in every generation.
Sure.
But the standard of the average individual was so strong. When you were listening to his stories, how did this affect your thinking relative to the modern-day world that we have today?
I was really struck by it, and I think following your line of questioning right there, I think the sense of community is how it affected me the most. When his dad was a superb seaman. He had sailed on the last of the full rig ships in the late 1800s, and so he taught his boys that seamanship. When he came back from Alaska, he built a workboat that was based at Winslow on Bainbridge Island. And as you read the story, you find that workboat was not only used as earning money for his family, but it was used for community purposes. Mm-hmm. And a woman was pregnant and had to get into Seattle to a hospital. They didn't have ferries in those days. They had mosquito fleet boats, but they ran on a schedule, and babies don't come on schedules.
So, they never do.
Yeah, so he would take women, pregnant women in, or somebody who had been hurt in an accident at the shipyard there. There's one story where he's chasing a couple of robbers who are trying to get away in a rowboat. It just goes on and on of that community use, and the sense of community, the sense of helping each other. Holger mm-hmm. mentions that quite a bit, that if they caught fish and they had extra fish, they made sure they gave that fish to the neighbors.
Absolutely, and they always seemed to know who needed help. And I knew someone many years ago who had survived the Great Depression. And there was a knowingness if someone needed help, if someone needed food, it would just show up at your door. Or they'd say, well, I'm cleaning up my refrigerator. And at that time, you know, when you're talking about his dad, J. Holger Christensen's dad, things were just done. You didn't make much ado about it. You just give people, you saved their face, so to speak.
You
honored them, respected them, and everybody was on a code of honor to a degree. I mean, that was a time when people didn't lock their houses, and you wanted to make sure that if anybody ever needed help, that there was that sense of commitment, and like you said, community. Now, one of the things with your uncle and his story that I was intrigued with, because there's a lot of information about his dad, which was just amazing. In fact, one of the largest explosions that ever occurred here occurred on his dad's boat that blew up because of what they suspected was a spark from a forest fire
exactly.
that had come through the air. And his dad was hauling explosives for DuPont. And that is a fascinating story. That is just amazing, amazing that anybody even survived that. But they did. Nobody was hurt.
No.
A 10-foot hole in the ground with the explosion and so much more in description. But also, you go in to your uncle's stories about traveling to different parts of the world, the food ships that the Russians needed, that the Americans provided food. This was Second World War period. The traveling. I was astonished to learn about the islands, you know, Guam, Wake Island, which anyone that is familiar with World War II history, these islands were incredibly important. And I believe it was Wake Island that when they went to this island and there was preparation being made in advance for war with the Japanese, this whole island was overrun with rats.
Yeah, that's quite
that
a story.
That just blew me away. I thought, rats? What in the world did they have to live on?
Yeah,
but there were literally millions of them, and they had to get rid of them.
Yeah, that I thought that was fascinating. That was part of, I think, one of the more interesting historic things in the book. They were preparing those islands as bases for the Pan American Clipper ships, the huge seaplanes that opened up trans-Pacific air travel. And that was, I think, in 1937. And they already, even at that time, the Japanese were surveilling them. They would overfly them or sneak up alongside with one of their Navy cruisers.
Right, and they would do their silent runs where they would observe everything that was going on in the island.
Right.
The mode of secrecy with the Japanese at that time was just amazing. But backpedaling a little bit, one of the things that your uncle said, in the Pacific Northwest, the Japanese people that had come and settled in the Pacific Northwest prior to World War II had done this incredible job of clearing land, building farms. And I was deeply moved by his story about the people and how wonderful these people were and how they never signed contracts. They were just agreements. Well, you'll keep your word.
Absolutely.
Yes, I will. This is the way people were working at that time. Nobody today would even give a hope or a prayer for that. But by golly, then, and these Japanese people cultivated the land very carefully. They had berries. And there was this agreement with your uncle's dad, and you know he was involved when he was growing up. And I loved the stories about how when he was a 12-year-old, he was running a boat.
Yeah, that's right.
Your uncle was running a boat. Today we say they can't even do anything. We've got so many rules and regulations. Kids can't be doing anything. They just are. I mean, it's just ridiculous what we've gotten to. But at that time, young men and young boys were expected, and they were encouraged. They were encouraged to be self-sufficient and independent. And he was, my goodness, at 16, your uncle was out and about doing things on boats.
One of the interesting things about that, I think, is that his dad, we called him Cap Christensen. His dad would. He had four boys and two girls. Holger was the second in the family. And when each of the boys reached 6 years old, he would tether the boy to the mast of his workboat and take him along on his trips and start teaching him seamanship that way.
Mm-hmm.
And then by the time they were 9 or 10 years old, they were helping out as deckhands.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
and I think it's marvelous. It taught him a self-sufficiency that I think just is amazing. Just absolutely amazing. And maybe some people would disagree with me, but I think teaching self-sufficiency is part of childhood. And Holger's experiences in Shanghai during the Second World War and what he shared about the Chinese people and how the men that worked the ships in China were literally slaves. They had no choices. And he made the comment that he understood why Mao became the power head that he did for all of the butchery that was done to their own people. Mao got into power because the conditions for the Japanese, the average person, was just so horrific. So horrific.
Yes, sir.
And they just said, we've got to get out of this. And they went from one form of prison into another. Fascinating thing. And here we are today. We're finally some freedoms. are being allocated to the Chinese. But it's marvelous. Now, this is your book, Sea Travels.
Right.
And this is a story about J. Holger Christensen. So for those of you listening, this is the memoir of the sea. The history in this is incredible. Now I want to move to your other book, Sasha Plotkin's Deceit. Now, for those of you that love spy novels, for those of you that love intrigue, this is just an amazing read. And, Vaughn, you're a marvelous writer. But when you decided to do this novel, there is a big jump from doing something that is nonfiction into the novel, and you seem to have bridged that just phenomenally well.
Thank you very much. It was not an easy change, I have to tell you. You know, particularly when you're writing reports and cables for the CIA, you have to be brief. You have to be totally accurate. You don't embellish in any way whatsoever. And that is absolutely opposite of writing fiction. And I have to say that I did take a year's course at the University of Washington in novel writing. As I started on this, I realized I needed some help. Mm-hmm. And that, of course, helped a lot. But I've always enjoyed writing.
Well, obviously. And you're just a wonderful writer.
Thank you.
Sasha Plotkin's Deceit. It is categorized under fiction espionage. The time frame you choose is 1972. It's about the Soviets planting their spies in the CIA and various characters that are playing their roles in this. With this story, did you have to share it with the CIA before you published it?
Indeed, I did. Yes, you sign a secrecy agreement at the termination of your career that lasts your lifetime, of course. And one of those agreements is that you'll never release any classified information. So the CIA has a publications review board, and anything that you write for publication that might contain something like that has to be submitted to them.
Mm-hmm.
And they will let you know whether it's acceptable or not, or they'll edit out certain areas.
Your suspense begins right in the very beginning, the prologue, when you're setting up the story. Because it's April 2nd, 1972. You have a man by the name of Hans. He is a spy. And one of the sentences is that he's getting ready to do the mission he's supposed to do. And he is so frightened that he can smell his own fear. And there's KGB. They're aware of everything that he's doing, and I won't say what happens to Hans, but it leads right in to this incredible novel that you feel like you're really walking through all of these periods with this, because you did work for the CIA. How much research went into this for you?
Well, there's a lot of research involved, and particularly it includes the story of a village of Swedes that existed in Russia from the late 1700s until the 1920s. And that village, they kept the Swedish language, they had a Lutheran church. It was Sweden all over again, and this little farm area on the Dnieper River up above the Black Sea. I learned about that. I served 5 years in Sweden, and I learned about that there, and I talked to a man who was an expert in it and did research in the newspaper morgues and really came out with much more information even than you see in the book and the novel.
When you were incorporating this in, because you had research that is public information, I'm sure that there are various aspects of experience that you were able to incorporate in. It's sort of like anyone that is writing about anything that is close and dear to their heart, whether it's carving a wood duck or being a boxer or something else, there has to be that relationship, that association in some way, because there's a process of thinking that goes on to really be able to do good undercover work, an extreme level of discipline, I feel, and a touch of acting as well. Correct me if you think I'm wrong, but I think
you're not wrong.
It all goes together. It all goes together. It's a phenomena that I think is just tremendous. And your primary character is Chris.
Correct.
Now, Chris is an interesting guy, and he's got a wife who is very much aware that he's, you know, got work he's dedicated to. But this starts off with a plot it's as if something from the past catches up with him. And he's got a commitment, he's got a responsibility, he's got an obligation. And she's not too happy about that. Who'd you base the female character on?
Somewhat on myself. One of the differences is that I'm not a fluent Russian speaker as Chris is. But he goes through the same assignments that are almost parallel to my assignments. What else here can I think of? I am not from a wealthy family as he is in the story, but generally the same kind of work I did.
Mm-hmm. You talk about the division. You give positions of people in authority, and there are a couple of sentences. I'm going to take them right from your book. Emotion is the best driver for creating unerasable memories. That
right.
is very, very true. Those memories that you have a strong emotional association with, they are vivid. They don't leave. And then you say, in another sentence, another part of the book, master of tradecraft, the mysterious set of skills needed to recruit, train, and run intelligence agencies. And I had to chuckle when I read that, because I've interviewed other people that have been involved with the CIA, the FBI, and some other things, and they say that they look for a certain personality type. There are components for certain jobs that they want to put together. And working with the evaluations of people, especially when they're coming out of college, it's very significant, because those personality traits are there. They could change, but generally, we've become so sophisticated in today's world. They were fairly sophisticated in 74, but in today's world, it's even more so. You really can get a pretty good idea about people, can't you? Their character and qualities and discipline from examination.
Yes, indeed, yeah.
Now, with this, you've got a Plotkin case, and there is so much about traveling between countries. And when we think of what we have to do today, in our world today, when I'm going through your book and I'm realizing you're talking about the 70s, how different it was then, because people could go from one place to another easily, not being accounted for.
Well, much more easy, absolutely.
I don't know how anybody could do it today. They'd
yeah.
have to have some kind of underground situation to be a part of, because in today, everybody, it takes us so long just to go through the airport. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Absolutely amazing.
I know. I suffer from that every time I travel, for sure.
You go into recruiting. You go into backgrounds on people, various environments. There's a lot of emotion, a lot of feeling that is in your book, Loyalties in the Strangest Places, and Sasha Plotkin's Deceit. Sasha Plotkin, where did you get the character? Where did he come from? Was he a composite? How did he come to life?
When I talk about this book, when I make appearances, I always tell the story of my time in Denmark. I spent almost 10 years in Scandinavia and have kind of roughly divided between Denmark and Sweden. While I was in Denmark, I got to know my opposite number in the KGB. And he knew who I was. I knew who he was. But our personalities matched, and I'm sure you've had this experience where you're at a party and you meet somebody casually, and suddenly you realize that there's an attraction, mutual mm-hmm. attraction between you, and that mm-hmm. happened to us, and we exchanged dinners, his wife and a couple of other people from the Soviet embassy, and he would come to our house for dinner. We'd go to their house. We'd see each other at diplomatic luncheons. We just enjoyed each other a lot. And that's really where he came from, where that character came from.
Well, the character is an amazing personality, and there's twists and turns that one wouldn't even imagine. But I found a statement from Sasha, says, corruption and cronyism are a part of any monolithic state. I was able to rationalize that fact is the price citizens pay for stability in such a huge, diverse country as the Soviet Union. The problems are much worse in the Politburo and KGB than in the Soviet military. I thought, wow, that is so real.
And that was Sasha Plotkin saying that.
Right.
The KGB officer himself.
Mm-hmm. And so those statements, I've known Russians that have made those statements. I know Russians today who are saying it's going backwards in their country. It's going backwards. Putin is taking on the role and enforcing certain things that the Ukrainians are terrified of.
I have no inside information anymore, but certainly I get that opinion from reading the press.
And the Ukrainians, we have association with the Ukrainians, and they go back to their country, and they're just terrified at the way they're seeing things changing. It's like things are shifting back to the old Stalin era, and this is not what we want. Now, I know we're just about out of time. For those of you listening, Von Sherman is my guest. Two books. You couldn't imagine that someone would go from nonfiction into fiction. The one that is nonfiction is Sea Travels, Memoirs of a 20th Century Master Mariner. His uncle, J. Holger Christensen, and it's just an amazing read, absolutely amazing read, because it tells of history that very few kids are even going to be made aware of today, much less adults being aware of it. The other one is a novel, Sasha Plotkin's Deceit, and I'll tell you, it is a gripper. It'll absolutely intrigue you. And as he said, before this book went to publication, it was submitted to the CIA for review. But I know that you'll find it interesting because there's a lot in this book that has traits of people that Von Sherman has actually known. So it's an intriguing situation. Check out his website, vonsherman.com. That's V-A-U-G-H-N, Sherman.com. Von, keep up your writing. You do it marvelously. And what's your next book?
I'm working on, it's not exactly a sequel, but I'm working on another novel that incorporates some of the characters from the Sasha Plotkin novel.
Oh, great.
And I only have an outline so far, but I hope to complete it within about a year.
Well, you'll have to send me a copy.
Okay.
Thank you, Donna.
I thank you for your kind words.
It's my pleasure. I don't say them lightly. I say them sincerely. This is Donna Seaball. We're taking a break. Don't go away. More good things to share.
Are you taking too many oral pain pills and concerned about the side effects? Are you having trouble getting to sleep at night because of the pain? Well, I'm Lou Paradise. I had the same problems you have, cured my pain, eliminated pain pills and their side effects by developing Toprasin, pain relief and healing cream. Toprasin relieves pain without the side effects. It doesn't burn, it doesn't smell, and it doesn't stain. But don't take my word for it. Doctors, pharmacists, and pain specialists are using and recommending Toprasin and ending the suffering for thousands of people just like you. We know you hurt. We want to help. We are so sure that Toprasin will work for you, we offer a money-back guarantee. So if you want the pain relief without the side effects, ask for Toprasin. Toprasin is available at Duane Reade, Quick Check Pharmacies, and Wegmans. Ask for Toprasin or call 1-800-959-1007 for a store near you. That's 1-800-959-1007. Toprasin, the last pain medicine you'll ever need, and you can sleep on that.
Donna Seaball publishes a popular, inspirational, and insightful newsletter filled with information about her upcoming guests, her travel schedule, seminar presentations, and upbeat articles to lighten up your life. You can subscribe to this free monthly newsletter by emailing her at donna@delphiinternational.com. That's donna@delphiinternational.com. You can also go to her website, www.delphiinternational.com, and review past publications. Keep in touch with Donna through this monthly publication. Again, her email address is donna@delphiinternational.com, and her website is www.delphiinternational.com.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. Telephone number to call into is 888-627-6008. 888-627-6008. Well, today's the big day. This is the last day to vote, so if you haven't done it, please do so. It's very important. I think that the right to vote is an extremely significant one. And so many times people say, well, what difference does it make? It can make a difference. This is something where people have, well, in the past, fought very hard for that right to be able to put their voice, put their vote into action. And that is the one thing that is really a saving grace. Look at how many places around the world you're not even able to do that. And especially you gals out there, don't forget, there are a lot of women that dedicated their lives so that we would have a right to vote. It's less than 100 years ago that women were literally, in the United States, tortured and abused because they wanted to. And I'm not exaggerating. Check your history. Can you imagine being in a jail cell and someone putting a hose into your mouth and flooding your body with water? You think of those stories just applying to aspects of war? Well, it was a war. It was a war between those that had, that didn't want, those that wanted to have the opportunity to vote, to have the right. And those were the women. The women had fought very, very hard. They were beaten. All kinds of things happened to them that was under the grace of the president at that time, Woodrow Wilson. So you need to remember a lot of the rights that we have today came about because people stood up and said, I deserve to have a voice. Your one vote makes a difference, even though you may not think so. So just go and use that right. Don't just let it evaporate away. Don't do that. This is Donna Seaball. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. 888-627-6008. Well, I have a number of little oddball things. You know, Thanksgiving is coming up. And, of course, the biggest thing with Thanksgiving is the fellowship with friends and family. It is just, Christmas and Thanksgiving. They are just huge, huge, significant holidays. And food, I know, because at Christmas time, we always have a full house of people. And Thanksgiving is one holiday that I opted out on years ago. I have some wonderful friends that usually have something, so I'll contribute. But I don't, the big, big meal for me for having a house full of people is Christmas. So there are other friends of mine. We choose to get together on Thanksgiving, and we all bring something and contribute in our own way, our specialty. And for me, it's always dessert. But so many times when we are looking at the holiday, and especially if you're a younger person, and maybe this is going to be your first big Thanksgiving bash that you're going to do. And, you know, there are some things that you learn by observation from the women that you've been around. And it always brings to mind a very dear friend of mine. He's passed away now. His name is Robert. And Robert and his wife often were guests at our home table. And Robert just enjoyed good food. He enjoyed food, and I'm a very good cook. And so we would just have, I'd have a lot of fun putting a meal together. And he had a lot of fun just eating it. And he shared a story one time. He said he had always thought when he was growing up that his mother was just a fabulous cook. He came from a rather poor family, and he said, "This is, you know, my mother, I just thought she was the best cook in the world." Well, that was until he joined the Navy. And then he found out that food tasted different in the Navy, and it was fresh and it was good. And he said, "Wow, this is the best food I've ever had. This is just great." He realized that what Mom had done wasn't so hot. However, then he got married to his first wife, and she was a better cook than the Navy. And he said, "Wow, I didn't think anything could get any better than that." Well, he ended up getting a divorce from his first wife after a few years, and then ended up marrying his lovely wife, Barbara. Well, Barbara is a gourmet cook. And he said, "That's when I really knew how good food could taste." And I always like to share the story because we grow. As we become exposed or become aware of different things, we realize that sometimes those that we might have thought were good cooks because we have nothing else to compare with, they're not so good. And that's what Robert realized. He said, "My mother was a horrible cook. She'd cook everything until it was just so dead that it just wouldn't even have any body to it." And he said it was the way she had been raised, but he said he really learned how to enjoy good food. So when you're cooking and you're preparing the Thanksgiving meal, some tips that can really help, and this one tip that I learned years ago, it's a little bit tough to manage. You might want to have somebody assist you, and that is with the turkey. A lot of people today are not putting turkey inside the dressing when they bake the turkey, and they're putting it in separate casseroles. Well, I was shown a number of years ago, and this can be done with chicken, by the way, too, if you're going to be serving roast chicken instead of turkey, because some people don't like turkey. You roast it upside down. You go and maybe you fill it with onions or oranges, whatever you want to have as a flavor, and you stuff it with something like that. And you turn the turkey and or the chickens upside down. It keeps the breast meat from drying out. Now, the juices from the dark meat go into the white meat, and oh, it is so very, very good. Now, you've got another option that you could put a piece of cheesecloth soaked in butter. But it's very important to know that if you're not going to stuff it, if you turn it upside down and cook it that way, let's say 3/4 of its time, and then go and turn it over. Now, if you have a big turkey, you really need someone to help you with this. Trust me, I've tried doing it. It's not so good when you have the roasting pan, and if there should be any little bit of sticking, you want to make sure that you have another pair of hands there to keep the roasting pan in place, because that's going to be a pretty hot oven when you go to turn it over. So you can remove it from the oven, turn the turkey over, and what I get are two big mitts sometimes, and you can wash them afterwards, and you take the mitts and you lift them. But if you have another pair of hands, and my husband has often helped me with this, and then you flip it so that it's right side up, you could put a piece of buttered cheesecloth on the top, but your white meat is going to be delicious. You actually can roast it upside down for the entire time. It's up to you what you want to do. But I prefer flipping it over so that the skin on the top gets a little bit more golden brown. Now, if you don't have a roasting rack, you can take tuna cans, empty tuna cans, and use them to keep the turkey elevated off the bottom of the pan, and you can position them accordingly. But it's a lot easier if you do have the rack that'll keep the bird in the positioning that you want. And I came across this suggestion, and I just loved it. I thought, this is so true. If you have friends, as I do, that are vegetarians, please don't fix tofu. What you want to do is maybe have something like a vegetable lasagna, because all of your guests will enjoy it. Tofu is not something that a lot of people go woohoo about. So you want to be able to have foods that are going to be flavorful and delicious that everyone can taste, because there's delicious vegetarian dishes that anybody's going to enjoy. So figure out something that your entire crew of guests will be able to enjoy, whether they're vegetarian or not. And if you're going to have a small group of people, don't buy a huge turkey unless you really enjoy leftovers, which I do. And what do you do if a turkey is still raw? Oh, what you do, if you know that your turkey has not completely cooked, if any of the meat is pink, then what you do, you just go and carve it up, spread it on a baking sheet, put it back in the oven, and let it continue to cook. And believe me, it will cook. And by the way, don't try to carve a turkey. Let it rest for a good 15 minutes because it continues to cook. It really, really does. But if that is a problem you have, just go ahead and put it back in the oven for a while. It's all timing. And it's something that after you do it for a while, you sort of get your rhythm into place. But you always have to be on guard, especially when you have a big group of people, because things can go awry. Somebody can interrupt you, distract you. I mean, there's all kinds of things. So try to have it sort of, I like to have things sort of written out in front of me so I keep my focus. I also shoo people out of my kitchen. I remember the last big dinner I had, someone was in there just chattering away, and I finally had to say, excuse me, I'm in the middle of stuff. I need to focus and concentrate. Would you please join the other guests in the living room? Oh, you don't want me here? I said, correct. I don't want you in the kitchen while I'm doing my work. I'm going to be presenting the food and bringing it out, so please, will you do that for me? And they did. They went out. And that's something, in your kitchen, set your boundaries. People love being in a kitchen, love chatting with you. But it's okay to say to those guests that are in the kitchen, if you're feeling like you're getting too distracted, say, please go join everyone. I've got to take care of some things, and I've got to give it my full attention. They won't hate you. They can hardly wait for the food to come out. That's one of the reasons they come together. And it's a good thing for people to chat and to interact. Anyway, that's just a few tips that I had that I thought I would share with you, because I think being able to present a good meal to your guests is just absolutely a nice table. It's just one of the most satisfying things that you can ever do. Good food, good people, good conversation. Hey, doesn't get any better than that. And being grateful for everything in your life, well, that comes along with it too, because we definitely have a lot to be grateful for. This is Donna Sebo. We're going to take a break. If you would like to chat with me, give me a call at 888-627-6008. I want to chat with you about an athlete when we come back, Lolo Jones, a woman that I think has such tremendous courage. She's an example to all of us. So that and a little bit more, a little bit of this, a little bit of that, and we'll be back in just a moment. Don't go away.
Have you ever had a friend tell you about a product they really believed in? Hi, this is Donna Sebo. Toprosin is a homeopathic cream that is just fabulous. I use it and my friends use it for relief of painful discomfort such as aching muscles and sore feet. Odorless, non-greasy, it is a product that belongs in everyone's medicine cabinet and first aid kit. Check out www.toprosin.com. That's T-O-P-R-I-C-I-N. And find out more information. You can order Toprosin online or call 800-959-1007. That's 800-959-1007. Be sure to give them the code DS30 and you'll receive a 30% discount. Toprosin, non-toxic, safe for children, too. This is a product that really works. Try it. I think you'll like it.
As a counselor, Donna Sebo is available for private consultations by appointment. These can be done by telephone or in person. If you'd like to schedule an appointment with Donna, call 253-582-5604 or 800-872-8852. That's 253-582-5604.
Hi, this is Donna Sebo. I wanted to share a cute story about a pot-bellied pig. Now, I don't know if you remember that there was a period where that animal was just, oh my goodness, when we'd see it on television, here's this adorable little pig. It's just so cute. Well, most people didn't realize that those adorable little piglets could end up being 800-pound wonders. Now, these are incredibly intelligent animals. And there is a speech pathologist, her name is Lois Brady. She has an assistant. Her assistant is a 70-pound miniature Vietnamese pot-bellied pig. And she is just beautiful. She's absolutely adorable. Her name is Buttercup. Now, Lois takes Buttercup with her to schools, especially to those groups of kids that are very detached. They don't interact. Animals are such a wonderful way to reach them. And we've all heard about dogs, but I had not heard about using a pot-bellied pig. Now, she's a miniature. She's a miniature, but she is absolutely adorable. She grows to the size of a basset hound, a large one. So that's how big she gets. Now, there was an 11-year-old boy in one of the classrooms that Lois took Buttercup to. And this child, always was hiding underneath the desk, would never, ever come out. The teacher just didn't know what to do. Here comes little chunky Buttercup. That child was so mesmerized by Buttercup. He, for the first time, left that underground world of safety that he just never wanted to leave to come out and to pet that beautiful pot-bellied pig. The other thing that happened that blew everyone away is that he started to talk. All because of that animal being brought in to the classroom. What a profound experience it had to be. The other students were surprised because this child never talked, just stayed in this cowering positioning underneath his desk. Well, we all know about dogs, but pigs. There's all kinds of myths around pigs. Pigs are one of the cleanest animals you'll ever find. Yes, I know they roll in the mud because they like it. They do it to get rid of insects, just like elephants do. But they are absolutely wonderful with children. Why? Because they're calm, they're very friendly, and the autistic children, especially, they have noted, because of Buttercup, the pigs seem to understand what the children need. And sometimes children, as all kids will do this, they'll hit or kick or pull an animal's tail. And what Buttercup does is when that happens, it's like, sorry, you're not treating me nice, and just walks away. Little Buttercup, the miniature Vietnamese pot-bellied pig. He doesn't fight back. He just moves on. So he is now a full-fledged classroom aide, and he actually lives in a doghouse in Lois's backyard. And she said Buttercup comes inside the house, loves to sit by the fireplace, and is happy as he can be when he is just treated like you treat a dog. See, treated like a fur person. They're extremely intelligent. I was amazed when I read this story, and I thought, how fortunate that someone opened up to this lady who realized that she had a very, very special pet. So if you should decide you want to get yourself a pot-bellied pig, make sure it's a miniature one, because then it's not going to get so big it won't even go through your front door, because they do get big. There's a lot of these animals that have been abandoned. In fact, there are rescue units for pot-bellied pigs because people don't realize how big they can get. And I remember hearing a story about a pot-bellied pig that was hundreds of pounds and saved the life of its mistress because she had had a heart attack or something physically very serious happened to her. And that pig went out and was in the middle of a road, laid down in the middle of the road, so it would force someone to stop. This animal figured out how to get the attention and then directed someone back to the home that this woman lived in and saved her life. Dumb animals? I don't think so. Lola Jones. This is a woman that I'm going to share some information about. I just think her courage is just amazing. And that's what I'm going to share with you. But tomorrow, if you're interested in money, if you feel that all of the nonsense that people are dishing out today would make it impossible for you to become a millionaire, I'm not kidding. You can do it. It was done by Bill Fisher. This is the father-in-law of a gentleman, Michael Burns, that we're going to be talking with tomorrow. We're going to find out how Bill Fisher, at the age of 70, started building a fortune. No kidding. And it was very simple. So we're going to be talking about that tomorrow. So tell your friends and join us. It's important to move forward with our thinking, not backward. Lola Jones. Now, she was recognized in 2008, the Beijing Olympics, on ABC's Wide World of Sports. Why? Because she suffered what is often called the agony of defeat. She was a gold medal favorite. She was doing the 100-meter hurdles. She was way out in front. She only had two hurdles to go. But she put one of her feet in the wrong positioning. The heel of her right lead foot clipped the top of the hurdle. She stumbled. She had made a very, very simple, tiny mistake. It was agonizing for her. She could have won, but she didn't. And she had had a life that, interestingly enough, was very similar to the hurdles, or was filled with hurdles, just as those that she tried to cross in that Olympic competition. Now, Lolo grew up in Des Moines, Iowa. She went to 8 schools in 8 years. She was the daughter of a single mom who had 5 other siblings, a total of 6 children to take care of. Times were tough. There was one summer when she was growing up, they had to live in a church basement. She would hide the information about where she lived from the other kids she went to school with. There came a point when Lolo said to her mom, "I'm not moving anymore." So this was something that when that happened, it was in Des Moines, Iowa, and she said, "I love running. I will not move anywhere where there's not a track." That was the beginning of her passion for being a runner. She stayed with different families, different friends, and then she, at LSU, she set collegiate records, led her team to a national title. She aimed for the Olympics in 2004, failed to qualify. But, you know, this woman worked. She did everything she could, anything and everything, because she was going to be in the Olympics. She won her first national championship in the 60-meter hurdle. 2008, she lost. But you know what? She said she took comfort from Frederick Douglass, very famous man. He said, "If there's no struggle, there's no progress." So she turned her focus to London and to being a part of the Olympics there. She's had to go through spinal surgery, all kinds of things, but this is a woman who is a champion. she keeps on no matter what life throws at her. Check her out, Lolo Jones. I think you'll enjoy it. We're out of time, my goodness. This is Donna Sebo. Remember always that you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. It is important for you to realize that you're here to be the best you can be. And I know your star is going to shine brightly. Won't you join me tomorrow so that we can learn about how you can make your financial star shine a little brighter? This is Donna Sebo. Have a fabulous day or evening wherever you are on this wonderful planet of ours. God bless. Talk to you tomorrow. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.